Okay, my name's Sharon Mitchell, and today's date is February the 16th, 2010, and I'm interviewing Charles Bogart.
Correct.
And this is going to be about his military experience. Now, is this pre-war?
This is U.S. Navy, 1958 through 1961, which makes it Cold War, and also I served during the Berlin Wall crisis and during the Formosa Strait crisis. So as a result, I got an Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal and a Navy Occupation Medal simply for being in the service at the right time or the wrong time. But I saw no combat.
Okay. Now you're going to have to help me out a little bit. What's the Formosa Strait crisis?
Formosa Strait crisis was in the 1950s. The People's Republic of China was trying to retake the islands of Quemoy, Matsu, which lie off their coast, which were still occupied by the nationalist Chinese who were based on the island of Formosa, the Republic of China. So you had the battle going on. The Red Chinese, I'll call them that, were showing the island and threatening to invade the islands of Matsu and Quemoy and retake them. And the U.S. had said no, that was belonged to the Republic of China, Taiwanese government, and that they were providing protection. Basically, all we did, I was a radarman on a radar picket destroyer, USS Dennis J. Buckley, DDR 808, and we steamed lazy figure eights or racetrack courses within the Formosa Straits between the island of Quemoy and Matsu and the island of Formosa, and we did radar picket out there. We pick up any aircraft flying on our radar and everything, identify it as a friendly bogey, bandit, and pass it off if it was a bandit, which is an enemy aircraft. We sort of looked upon any vessels, ships we saw sailing down through the straits. We did that for about a month and a half. That'd been December, January 1959, 1960 is when I was out there.
How did we get into this? What was the U.S. involvement that got us?
What the U.S. involvement in this was that when the Chinese communists took over the mainland China, there was a lot of problems within the United States. Well, my take is there was a lot of people within the government at that time who were of communist or communist sympathies, who were all for the communists taking over and for ideology reasons and stuff like that. You wind up with I can't think of the gentleman, the senator who...
McCurry?
Yeah.
Is that the right one?
Anyway, the senator who went out and did the un-American investigations and everything. And out of that, two groups were identified in the U.S. State Department. One was, quote, pro-communist. One was anti-communist and that. When the Korean War broke out, President Truman said that we would provide protection for the nationalist Chinese on Formosa. And the 7th Fleet, or elements of the 7th Fleet, were ordered down into the Straits to provide protection. So I don't know how long that continued. I assume it continued on up through the 70s with some U.S. ship in there. Generally, we always got a kick out of it because you'd see drawings of the island of Formosa, mainland China, and there'd be an aircraft carrier sitting in between there, and it'd say on it, 7th Fleet. No, there was never an aircraft carrier there. The aircraft carrier was always to the east of Formosa, out where he had room to maneuver. And what they'd have is one or two destroyers in there between Formosa and the Chinese mainland as tripwires, whatever you want to call it. We were in there to give advance warning of anything happening. So we operated out of Kaohsiung, Formosa, which was on the southern end of Formosa, on the Formosa Straits. And they were always rotating a few destroyers through that base. And as far as I know, it lasted up to maybe the 1980s. They were rotating ships in and out through there.
Okay. Now I'm going to back up.
Okay.
How did you, you say you were originally from Covington?
I was born at St. Elizabeth, but I lived in Newport or Fort Thomas all my life. I just happened to be born in St. Elizabeth in Covington.
So what was the atmosphere? Why did you decide to join?
Why did I decide to join the Navy? Because I believed in the sign hanging in front of the U.S. Post Office in Fort Thomas that said, join the Navy and see the world. I had never really been anywhere. I'd been to Washington, D.C., but I had never been anywhere. And as far as I knew, I was never going to go anywhere in my life traveling. So I was going to join the Navy and at least see something of the world and everything. And the Navy did do that. They sent me to California for boot camp, San Diego, sent me to San Francisco for schooling. Oh, man, San Francisco is an 18-year-old. You can't believe the fun I had out there. Then on a destroyer out of Long Beach, I got to Hawaii, to Japan, a number of ports in Japan, Okinawa, Hong Kong, Formosa, the Philippines. So I did get to, I saw a lot of the ocean, but I did see some of the world too. So it was a very neat deal. And as far as I'm concerned, the 3.5 years I was in the Navy were among the best years of my life, because I was a young kid on my own, just having a ball doing whatever I wanted to do.
And you say you went to radar?
Radar school at Treasure Island in San Francisco. I was told when I signed up for the Navy and took my test to get into the Navy that I was eligible for any position within the Navy. I wanted to be a yeoman, rider, or a storekeeper, something like that. I was immediately told once I was sworn in the Navy and everything and I was in boot camp that I was overqualified for those positions. Positions I was qualified for was sonarman, radioman, or radarman. They tried to make a sonar and a radioman out of me. The sonar, you listen to the beep, you've seen it all in the movies. It all sounded the same. They tried to make a radioman out of it. The dit-dats all sounded the same. So they made a radarman out of me. The first 10 weeks of radar school was electronics. I didn't know anything about electronics when I came in, and when I left, I didn't know anything about electronics. The second 10 weeks was hands-on stuff that I ate up, that I was very good in everything. Back up, how did I pass the first 10 weeks of school? Basically, I figured out along the way somewhere that when the Navy gives you these multiple choice tests, that they group 4 or 5 questions together and they build upon each other. So if you read all 5 questions, you can generally figure out what some of the answers are along the way. I may not know what it meant, but I could figure out what the answer was by reading these as a group, because one of them would answer the previous question, and by answering that question, I could figure out what the next question was. I was not a star pupil in that part. If I had made the same grades that I made in the last 10 weeks of school, in the first 10 weeks of school, I would have come out of the school as an E3. But I those first 10 weeks of electronic theory, my solution was you opened the cabinet, you looked inside. This is back in the tubes days. If the tube wasn't burning, you replaced it. Otherwise, if they were all burning, you pulled all the tubes out and checked all of them until you found the bad one. To hand me a schematic and ask me to read a schematic, I had no idea what I was looking at. It meant nothing to me. And a lot of the terms and formulas meant nothing to me. And it wasn't like I'm dumb. I don't want to think I'm dumb because I went on and got a master's degree and everything. It was just not within my...
So how did they pick you to do this, having that kind of a background? Or did you
it was just one of those deals. They needed people in these positions. I had scored so high on my entrance exam, therefore you are now qualified to go into this position, whether you really have an aptitude for it or not. And that's always the U.S. Navy had an extremely lousy program for taking care of its men. I will tell you that now. I don't know whether whether it's like that today, but back then, and they threw you into things that just for some reason I couldn't do. It was just like when we got on board the ship and everything within the Combat Information Center where I worked. Some of the stuff that was in there, you didn't have to tell me. I knew to do it. I mean, there's a lot of things in there. Taking care of the charts, working the electronic support measure gear and everything. Didn't have to tell me. It was there. I did it. There were other things that we had to do in there. They could spend 5 to 10 days talking to me about, walking me through it, and when it was done with, I didn't know any more than when I first started on it. It was, I can't explain it, but there was just certain things that I don't have any mechanical aptitude, I guess is what it is. And some of the stuff, it was just, and I knew it frustrated them very much, and it frustrated me that these things that came to them so naturally. But then again, they used to get up, couldn't believe that I liked to take the charts and make all the corrections on the charts, what buoy's gone, what new one's in, lighthouse changes, and all this sort of stuff. And that I ate that up. Matter of fact, I wanted to go off to school on that. And I remember talking to the division officer saying, there's this school, and I want to go off to it. And him asked me some questions about the chart, and me dumb-like answering the questions. And he said, you already know this stuff. There's no need to go to school. I was never so disappointed in all my life because it was just something that fascinated the heck out of me. Same way with electronic support measures. Electronic support measures was I operated equipment that gathered the electronic transmissions of, quote, the enemy, or whoever you want to say we were doing it off to. I found that extremely fascinating and everything because I sat there in front of this equipment. I had 8 bands I scanned. If I got a signal, I had an oscilloscope next to me that had 8 lines going across it, 8 guns, we called it. I had a camera. I would snap pictures of the oscilloscope. I had a tape recorder that I turned on, top-of-the-line tape recorder back in those days, one of the old wire tape recorders and everything. And then I would take a range and bearing on it. I had the position of the ship on the chart, and we would draw a line out from that. Later on, if I picked up the same signal and everything from wherever the new position was, I did the same recording. We drew a new line and everything. So if you get 3 or 4 cuts on that broadcasting site, you could fairly well pinpoint where it was ashore. So, you know, this was neat. This was, you know, but once again, I did all this stuff. I took the pictures. I took the tapes. I took the charts, and I gave them to the executive officer who sent them off, and I never knew whatever happened to them. I never had one person come back to me and say, you're doing a great job, you're doing a mediocre job, you're doing a lousy job. I never got any feedback. I assume I was doing a great job, because I assume if I wasn't doing a great job, I would have gotten whacked over it. But it was still very frustrating to sit there and do all this stuff and never get one word back to, yeah, you're getting what we want, you're doing this or that, but I enjoyed it.
Well, that was half of it, right? They just had you a round peg in a square hole kind of.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the other thing about the Navy personnel system that really burnt the heck out of me was all through radar school, we were told if we dropped out, if we failed, and they put us out, that we would get a job that we would hate for the rest of our life. We would be sent mess cooking, working on the mess deck and everything. So I graduate from school and everything. I report aboard ship. And what do? They send me off for 6 months of mess cooking on the ship. Now, wait a minute. I'm only going to be in the Navy for 3 years. I'll explain later how I wound up for 3.5 years. I've been in the Navy now for almost a year. He invested all this time and money in me to get me to be a trained radarman. And now you're throwing it down the tube by making me a mess cook for 6 months. That didn't make sense to me, and it still doesn't make sense to me. I only wound up mess cooking for about 3 weeks because the other guy that was sent on board ship with me, And once again, this is something that has amazed the heck out of me ever since, and I've seen it later, is that he was not the top student in the radar school with me, but one of the top students. I mean, bip, 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 he knocked the stuff out and everything. We got on board ship, and I assume I went mess cooking first because my Bogart started before his name. But anyway, he got into the CIC, and he couldn't operate in there. He could do any job you wanted him to do, providing he could do it in quiet, I don't know what the word I want to say, without other things going around him. But if all other kind of things were going around him, he couldn't focus on it.
Now, what's CIC?
CIC was Combat Information Center, where the radar and stuff like that was located. But I could sit in there. I could copy three different or four different radios going at the same time with no problem. I could do most of the things in there with certain exceptions, as I said, that I never figured out how to do, that were beyond me. But he could do any one job in there 100% better than I could do, as long as he was only doing that one job and he was doing it without commotion around him. But as soon as that happened, he fell apart. And I saw this later in life, working with other people that were extremely competent. But as soon as turmoil started going around them, they fell apart. And that was, so he wound up being sent to mess cooking and everything. And later he got transferred off the ship, and I lost contact with him. But I've always, it just struck me as so funny then, and it strikes me funny now, that here was some guy who was so much more intelligent than me. I'm willing to admit that. Understood everything more than I did, but yet couldn't function in the real world of doing it. Okay, I got off on the sidetrack again.
No, that's okay. That's interesting to know. And they probably haven't taken it into account yet.
Yeah.
Did you now, at that point, did they have women on board then?
No, there was no women on board ship. Thank goodness. I still think it's a bum idea to have women on board ship. I'm sorry if you want to make me a sexist or I want to. You're in too close of confinement on board ship, in my opinion, for that to work. I read and I hear about problems they have and everything, and I know I'm an old fogey from a different society and all that sort of stuff and everything. I just don't think I have no problems with the homosexual being on board the ship or anything like that. I just have problems with males and females working together and the close quarters you're working together. And it's not like it's a 8-to-4 job or 8-to-5 job. You get up and you leave. It's a 24-hour day job, 7 days a week, and you can't get away from everybody. You're encapsulated on board that ship. And
how long were you out or on the ship at a time?
Generally, stateside, we'd go out Monday morning, come back Friday afternoon. Occasionally, we were out for 2 weeks for training and everything. When we got into Westpac, which is Western Pacific's 7th Fleet, operating off of the coast of Asia and everything, that your operational span at sea was anywhere between 10 and 30 days before we went into port. Generally, it was about 3 weeks at sea, into port for a little while, then back out to sea for a while. I was on a destroyer radar picket. We were normally operating with a carrier group, except when we were detached into the Formosa Straits. We picked up new food and mayo and everything by underway replenishment, transferring it over, and you just stayed out at sea, and you operated. Generally, the ship was on 3-watch standards. That meant you worked 4 hours, you were off 8 hours, but you really weren't off 8 hours because you had compartment space to clean, you had to eat, you had to wash, you had all these other things and back on. Normally, Combat Information Center, when we would go overseas, we'd go on port and starboard, which meant we were on 6 hours, off 6 hours, on 6 hours, off 6 hours, which once again was a basic lie, because the 6 hours you were off, you had other things you had to do, so you couldn't sleep or anything like that. And many times, because of the tempo of the operations that the carrier was conducting, and this isn't war-taught, this is just normal peacetime operations and everything, is that you might be in CIC 18 to 24 hours straight without any sleep or anything, just maintaining operations going. We just didn't have enough men to man everything, so you had to do it like that. This is a young man's game, and there's no way I could do it today. But as an 18 to 21 year old, or you know, still in your 20s, you eat it up, and man, this is fun, and the responsibility that you're given. I noticed that too as I came out of the service. At one point, I still remember this. At one point, I was conducting air control. I had four airplanes up above me, fighters. I think they were demons, I think is what I had up there. And I was controlling four aircraft. I'm an E-3. I'm 19 years old. And I'm telling officers up there who are flying their airplanes what vector and not to take to, quote, intercept this pretend enemy. That's pretty hefty stuff for a young 19-year-old to say, you know, look, I'm doing things like this. And then you come out of the Navy and you're a piece of trash at the bottom of the list. I don't mean it quite like that, but mm-hmm. You know what I'm trying to say.
Well, you've had responsibility.
You've had responsibility. You're out, and all of a sudden you're just a young kid that don't know anything. And anybody who's been in the military, I think, has been given extreme responsibilities, which in the civilian world you would never get with the age that you're at for doing things and everything. So, yeah, I can't tell you how much I look back on that. It's just a huge, great time.
What did you do when you got out of the military?
Out of the Navy? Mm-hmm. I'll back up for a second. I knew I wanted to go to college when I was getting out of high school. But I really didn't know why I wanted to go to college. So the Navy was a point in between and everything. Also, didn't have any money. No GI Bill when I got out. But I did save money during the thing. I had money taken out, sent home into the bank before I saw it and everything. So when I got out, I came home and I went to college. Got a job as a maintenance engineer, janitor to you, but we called ourselves maintenance engineers. And worked my way through college doing maintenance. During the summer, I worked as a painter. I worked on the assembly line at the beer line at Wiedemann's Brewery. I bartended, I waitered. I did a whole bunch of things to get me through. I was living at home, so that took care of this part.
So
of
this came after all this
experience
that you had.
Then I went to college, and it was a little bit strange because there was one other guy there that I ran into who'd come out of the military too, and everybody else was just strictly out of high school and everything. And he and I, quote, had a slightly different outlook upon life than the other ones did and things like that. I guess we'd have been exposed to too much of the real world out there to that. But, yeah, you can still say, I look back on those as really fun days. And San Francisco is an 18-year-old.
I was going to ask you about. What was that like?
What was that like? I can't really tell you what San Francisco was like, but I was on a high the whole time, you might want to say. Not that I was on drugs or anything in that night. But I could always find a drink in San Francisco. Yes, I drank beer, wine, bourbons, and everything. I'm sorry, I'm out of Newport, Kentucky, Fort Thomas. I started to drink when I was about 5 years old up in that area. It was part of the German, Italian, Irish Catholic tradition that you just did that. So I did that. You could date girls and ride the public transportation. Nobody's thought anything unusual about going out with picking your date up, getting on the streetcar, riding it in, riding the cable cars. That was all accepted as part of the thing. The real big thing was they had a USO in San Francisco. I will tell you, the USO was one of the finest things that sort of happened to me along the way. They had dances and everything, so I met some nice young girls there. And I mean nice young girls. But the major thing was that they had tickets. Now, I never could get a ticket to a sporting event. because the U.S. Army was there at the Presidio. And those guys were always in there scoffing up those tickets before us guys got out of those, off of Treasure Island, got over to San Francisco and everything. But I got tickets to art shows, plays, gallery openings, and things like that. Now you're looking at me and say, why would he be think that? Well, I found out real quick like that you could go to these things and you got free cheese and hors d'oeuvres and alcohol to drink. I met some nice ladies at these things. As I've told other people, I wish I had paid more attention to who I was meeting or who were some of these artists in that I was rubbing shoulders with. But I was an 18-year-old who was just having fun, meeting some ladies. They were ladies, I will say that. They were all over 21 that I was bumping into, sipping with the wine and things like that. But I know I had to meet some, because some of the things I went to was readings. I have no idea who the guy was up there, the lady that was doing the readings. I have no idea who was putting on some of these plays. And the plays were off-Broadway plays, and they had a couple of, I don't think amateur is the right word, playhouses in San Francisco. But they were basically staffed with kids out of University of San Francisco or Oakland or something like that who ran these places and everything. They were home-written plays, I guess you want to say, with these people. And I can just remember having a great time going to them. I know some of the plays I thought were very dumb. I didn't care for anything, but it was free. There was some girls to meet. There were some drinks to be had, and let's go with life. Let's have some fun. And then I went from, I've said this before, and I will put it on here, and that General Sheridan is famous for having said back in 1866 that if he owned both Texas and hell, he'd rent out Texas and live in hell. When I went from San Francisco to Long Beach, my thought on it was, if General Sheridan had owned Long Beach in Texas, he would have rented out Long Beach and lived in Texas. Because Long Beach, California was going from, I don't know what I'm going to say, San Francisco being the greatest city in the world, to Long Beach, which was, if not the worst city in the world, pretty darn close to being the worst city in the world, at least for a serviceman.
Now, you said you've been several places now. What were the different ports like? What did you see?
Yeah. Okay. Got to Hawaii. Was to Hawaii four times. Hawaii, I guess if I owned Hawaii and Long Beach, I lived in Long Beach and rented out Hawaii. Hawaii was the pits for sailors. Thank goodness for Fort DeRussy, which was on Waikiki Beach. You could at least go there. I was in my sailor uniform, and I wandered into the various hotels along Waikiki Beach and was immediately escorted out of every one of them. Little or no love within me for Honolulu or Hawaii.
Why was that? The Navy just have a bad reputation with
them? I have no idea, but I think it was, we don't want dogs and sailors in our place, so get out. So that was my take on that. Yokosuka, Japan. Well, fairly near San Francisco. I always got past the first few bars. And then I was in the bar with the bar girls having drinks and everything like that. Yes, I was a young, wild kid carousing and everything. But half my paycheck was going home into the bank account. So I was, I didn't have all kind of money to spend. I did get out and walked around Yokosuka and everything. My opinion of the chaplain corps is they were the pits. As men of God, they were a complete failure because they never met one of my needs. And what were my needs I was looking for? I was looking for somebody to organize outings to Tokyo and other places to go and see instead of me just wandering to the bar. Later on, I did find a USO-type club. We were in our Yokosuka. I did two Westpac cruises twice out there. And I did find a club there run for the servicemen that did have some of those listed. So I did get to tour of Tokyo, to Kamakura, to Mount Fujiyama. I think those were the three tours I took there. So I did get out. We went to Osaka, where I got to go to see a... can't think of it. It's the plays in which all the actresses are females.
Okay.
And Kabuki. And I enjoyed that and got this go on another tour there, which was not arranged by the chaplains, but was arranged by the Japanese community on hosting us. We went to Beppu, which was their Yellowstone. Saw a little bit of that. And those people were nice enough, although I assume there was something in the back of it. See, we went to Hiroshima and got a tour of Hiroshima. And that. So I got to go see Ground Zero and everything. We went to Sasebo, which was a port city with a naval yard and everything, and girls and bars, basically. But I did find a tour to Nagasaki.
So how did the people receive you as being an American?
Well, see, I'm only dealing with the bar girls and the bartenders, or with the tour guide. I'm not mixing with the rest of the community. Okay. I'm in the segregated ghetto where the sailors and the Marines and that are supposed to be, and I'm not really. Although I did go out and walk around in the rest of the community, I never noticed anything per se, but you know, it was being American, you were tolerated, I guess is about best to say it, and everything. You're a big nose. I remember being told that we were considered big noses for some reason. That was their derogatory term for anybody who was not Japanese.
So of all the places that you went, is there some place you'd love to go back to?
I would sort of like to go back to There's a couple. I'd like to go back to Houston just to see if the bars and everything are still there and everything. The other place I guess I would like to go back to is really go up to Tokyo and see some more of that, because we just had a day trip there. We just drove past the Imperial Palace. We drove past this. We drove past that. And it was all this driving past stuff. And I'd like to go back and really see some of the stuff. Everything.
I was just wondering how well the navies, you know, see the world, how that panned out.
It panned out. I got to see a lot of stuff that I would have never seen and everything. I saw, you know, as long as I got out and did something. Okay. The first day ashore, I was going to get past. I did get past the first few bars. I was that smart and then was in a bar. Buying drinks, sitting and talking with a bar girl and things like that. But yeah, it was, it's a young kid. What more can you expect out of a young kid?
Okay.
Since we're talking about this, I might as well bring this up. Yes, the Navy was segregated in those days. The bars were segregated when I was there. There was nothing said or anything about it. The bars were segregated by ship. Or if not by ship, by ship type. This was the aircraft carrier guys over here, the destroyer guys here. The fleet replenishment ship guys went to these. And then there was a segment of it was called Black Market Alley, Thieves Alley. I don't know what the real name was. That's what we called it. That was the African-American part over there. And then there was another little section where the Filipinos went, because we had Filipino mess cooks and everything on. That went, and then there was another section, and there were not many, well, there were some Hispanics that went there. So it was, you noticed that, you noticed that they went like that. And it was nothing forcing it or anything. You just went like that.
Now, as far as being on the ship, were the jobs, more or less relegated into groups, the type of work that, say, one particular group did or didn't do?
Well, you came on board ship two different ways. You came on board ship three ways. Number one, you came on board ship straight out of boot camp with no training other side boot camp. You came on board the ship either as in the seaman branch or as a in the fireman branch, which meant you were assigned to the deck force or you were assigned to the fire room, the boilers and, okay. and that and everything. You were whatever they needed somebody for, you were shoved into that. You had some people that came on board who were naval reservists. They're coming on board with some training. They've been promised something, and basically they got what they were promised. No guarantee, but basically they got. Then there was the third group of us that went to Class A schools. Every gunnery, boilerman, all the ratings, everybody was assigned a rating. I was a radarman. There was radio men, there was sonar men, there was electronic technicians, quartermasters. There was about 100 different ratings and everything. You came on board and you were assigned to that section. I was in what was called Operations Division. I was in the OI Division, which was the, quote, Intelligence Division, which consisted of radar men and electronic technicians. The other side, which was the OC side, consisted of the radio men, and the signalmen and the quartermasters were over in that section. So that made it, there was 48 of us. There was 24 of us in the OI division. 16 of us were radar men. So that meant the other 8 were electronic technicians. And the electronic technicians were split into 2 groups too. Half of them worked on radar and half of them worked on radios. And then the other one. So you wound up in your sections, you slept, whatever your group was, you were assigned a space on board the ship to sleep in. Now, as a radarman, our principal job was, under normal conditions at sea, I worked the surface search radar repeater for an hour, moved to the air repeater for an hour, went to monitoring radio traffic for an hour, and then I maintained the status boards for an hour. That was the end of a 4-hour watch and everything. If we were doing some sort of operations, I might have been on the height finding radar, which told you how high the planes were. I might have been in on electronic support measure equipment, running that. I might have been copying radio. But generally, I was either on electronic support measure and that. Now, once I was, quote, off a watch, I had some different duty assignments. One of my duty assignments was to maintain the T2 trainer. The T2 trainer was an early computer game, which supposedly put computer type little dots and everything upon your radar scopes so you could pretend like there were planes coming or ships and things like that coming at you. The only time it worked was when the company who owned it, the technician was on board ship. As soon as he was gone, it went down. I was assigned to maintain that. That was great, because that just meant I went down there, wrote it was non-operable, laid down on the floor, and went to sleep in the little compartment. And I think they gave that to me because I couldn't do much wrong down there. I was also responsible for cleaning the compartment we slept in and taking the laundry up to the laundry once a week and bringing it back down. Everybody took their laundry and put it in various bags. You had your names on your clothes, went up, was washed, not ironed, just washed, came back, and then I threw it on your bunk. I also then cleaned the floor once a day, ran a mop over it, emptied the trash can. I also had an outside space to clean. I had one of the bulkheads, and I was responsible for cleaning the bulkhead on what was called the SBA radar shack. This was a 16 by 16 foot room located on the O1 deck, which is the first deck above the main deck in which the SPS-8 radar sat on. Your job was to wash it down, supposedly every day. I generally did, maybe once or twice a week. Because what's happening is you're picking up spray, salt water, which corrodes, and you're picking up gas stacks. The stacks are that, and that gas is coming down. It's got fine grit and oil and everything in it. And that's getting on the thing. It deteriorates the paint. It causes the metal to rust and everything, so it has to be washed down. So my job was, like I said, everybody from, particularly, I was E3 by that time. E4, you're up to petty officer. Everybody below that has a assignment to do cleaning on the ship. The E4s and the E5s generally had assignments for maintaining pieces of equipment and things like that and making sure that was done. The taking care of the charts should have really been not me, but somebody higher, because everybody hated the job and I loved it.
So you got it.
I got it, yeah. So that was fine with me because it was a job I liked doing.
Okay. What about the food and talking about everyday living?
The food was good food. I can't knock the food. Oh, occasionally they came up with lousy food. Occasionally we about ran out of food, so you know you got to expect things were lousy. And I never did get to liking to eat what are the prepackaged egg stuff. They were eggs that you added water to
become the dried eggs.
Yeah, the dried eggs. That always was green and it was always slopping back and forth. I was always seasick. I was seasick for the first 3 days we'd be at sea. After that, it'd be okay. I've since just past few years learned I'm missing my right inner ear. So that was why I had, and until my eyes and body and everything got loose, was going on, I was having a problem. And once everything got back in sync, the problem was you came back in port and I lost the whole thing. We had to start all over again. Okay, back to the food. The food was basically very good and everything, very good meals and everything. I did work in the gallery for a while, helping them cook and everything. The food was well done and everything. We had 4 meals a day. We had breakfast, lunch, dinner, and mid-rats. Mid-rats was served 11:30 to midnight. And that was the people for going on the watch then. Midnight on is when the baker came, baked the breads and all those things like that and everything. The big thing to do was to steal a loaf of hot bread. You got in big trouble if you did it, but by golly, it was worth getting in big trouble to steal a hot loaf of fresh bread and just sit there and eat that loaf of fresh bread. And it was good. So that was it. Then once in a while, when we were in port, on Sunday, they would have, you do your own cooking, your own breakfast. There would be no breakfast or lunch served. And they would bring eggs in, they'd bring steak in, sausage, bacon. And it was, you just came in there anytime between, I guess, about 6 o'clock in the morning and noon and cooked whatever you wanted to cook out of what was sitting there. So you could put together whatever you wanted. But overall, I'd say the Navy was top-line food. It was good food there. Now, having said that, 1960, it must have been Christmas in 1960, the Great Cranberry Scare. You too young to remember this. But there, some reason or the other, some cranberries got treated with some sort of chemical which was going to cause you to grow greenhorns, your eyes were going to fall out, and all this sort of stuff and everything. So there was this big thing of recall. So I remember coming on board ship that we had to check our cranberries to see what they were. To check the cranberries, they were in cases which were in the bottom of the ship. Now, I got assigned to this. I wasn't mess cooking. I was just pulled to do this. And we had to go down and open the hatch. It was between the lower deck and the outer skin of the ship. This is what you're in. And this is where the cans were. And we finally got the cases and pulled them out. And there on the packages, it was plainly said, packed in
1945.
So I never really paid attention, but I noticed once in a while that the canned goods would come in. They had a fairly old date on them and everything, but they cooks knew how to cook them, so they came out of everything in that. We did one time take on board our ship rejected Army food. We were in Okinawa. We had basically run out of food on board ship, which is hard to believe, but we had run out of food. Couldn't pick up a supply ship to get resupplied. Went into the port of Naha in Okinawa and put out an order for food, and food was delivered on the truck, and all the package things were had reject or condemned on them. I can't remember, U.S. Army. And there was a discussion, and it was decided that we would take it. I believe the problem with it was that it was native vegetables, which most probably have been fertilized with night soil. So the thing was, we weren't allowed to eat any of it raw. It was all well cooked. Well, at least we got food.
And night soil is?
Night soil is your human droppings, which is used for fertilizer. They go around, empty out the cesspools, go and spread it out as fertilizer. So that was one of your big problems when you were overseas, was the fresh vegetable issue. And my thought was, well, good golly, I go into restaurants, bars, and whatever you want to say it, when I'm ashore, while I'm overseas, I eat the food there. I saw a couple guys get sick. I never got sick from stuff like that. But I guess maybe I was a little bit more careful. I always made sure whatever I ate ashore was cooked. I didn't eat raw stuff and everything like that. But it was the way and everything.
In the future, or do you have children? I don't think
I got one daughter, okay. And I got one granddaughter.
What would you want them to know about your military Navy experience?
I've,
20 years from now.
I have told them stuff, and I've actually written an account of everything. My wife was a little bit upset with it because I talk about how you picked up a girl, saw and got her, and you went off to the little room to have your little sexual relationship. But that was all part of being a young sailor back in those days and everything. Most probably still true today and everything. It was, opt up. I wanted my daughter to join the National Guard. She wouldn't do that. I still think it would have been a great thing for her and everything. And if my granddaughter wanted to join, I'd be more than happy that she would, because I think that's it gives you some experience and other things that you just don't pick up in the civilian world and everything. And I makes you something. I was really enjoyed the whole bit. Okay, back talking about the ship for a minute and everything. 70% of the time we were at sea, we were in nice, smooth water out to sea and everything. We did occasionally hit some various heavy storms, rocking and rolling all over the place. I'm trying to remember. I don't want to shock you, but I'm trying to remember what we said as we walked down the passageway. Well, okay. Roll, you bitch, roll. Rock, you bastard, you rock. And because the ship would be doing those two things. It would be rolling from side to side and pitching up and down. And like I said, after 3 days, it didn't bother me. But up until that point, it could really tear me up and everything. We did, one guy got transferred off the ship because he wound up rupturing his stomach from heaving, from seasickness and everything. I never got that sick, but I did get so sick that one time I did basically collapsed in the passageway. I was laying in water, slopping back and forth, with a little bit of my vomit in it. Sounds good, doesn't it? And guys walking up and down the passageway, stepping on me. Now, hey, blank here, sick, haha. Yeah, I would have done it to my buddies too. That was part of being a buddy on board a ship and everything. That was the sickest I ever got. And after I'd laid there for 5 hours or so, I remember the chief coming out and telling me to go down and get cleaned up because I was due on watch again. So I staggered down and cleaned up, came back, and had my coffee bucket in my hand so I could.
Was there any medicine or anything that they get, or anything that would help?
One time they gave me some medicine. I can't remember what it was, but it was great stuff. because I was out for about 24 hours. That was it. So they decided that wasn't a good idea. I thought it was a great idea because I didn't have to do anything. I just lay there and slept. And I don't know whether it was 24 hours, but it was like 12 to 14 hours or something like that. I was just out. They said they couldn't wake me up or anything. I was just gone. And so I forget what it was, but it was supposed to prevent seasickness. No, I never found anything. The only thing I would do is there was always crackers on the mess deck. I'd grab as many crackers as I could. You got to keep something on your stomach. I would buy licorice, and I would munch on licorice. I'd have some chewing gum to chew on, and as long as I was out in the open, I could basically control it. But the problem was when I got into Combat Information Center, particularly when I was on the radar scope. Because what I'm doing is sitting up against, you've seen radar scopes, mm-hmm. what they look like. And I'm sitting there with my legs around it. The fan that cools it is blowing hot air down my lap, which is then coming up into my face. And I'm sitting basically on the center line of the ship. So I may not be rocking that much, but I can see. And of course, my fellow sailors, and I would have done the same thing, was we had display board, 360 degrees display board. You've seen them in war movies where they're plotting the aircraft and everything. And what you did was, it was almost on the center line of the ship, and what you did was hang down through the center of that a string with a pen tied on the end. So as the ship rocked, you could see how much you were rocking. That was great fun. That was to see if you could make anybody sick. So that was part of the deal. I mean, there was all kind of things that were done that were, you sit back and think they were juvenile, but they were great fun. And many of them were against me. But as I said, if I could have done them, I would have done them against my fellows, sailor and everything.
What did you do for recreation while you were on ship?
While I was on board ship, I read, and I read, and I read. We had a ship's library. We had an E6, first class petty officer who was in charge of the library, who got paid some money for being in charge of it. He turned the library over to me, and I ran the library. So that meant that every couple months when the big boxes of paperbacks came on board, I went through the boxes, got all the paperbacks I wanted to read, stuck them aside, and then when I read them, I put them back in circulation. You were supposed to pick the paperbacks up, take them out, and bring them back. That never really happened because, I'd be reading it, and somebody'd come along and say, oh, when you're finished with that, could I have it? Okay. It didn't get back to the library. I just handed it off to them and that. So they circulated. So I did a lot of reading. We played cards, a lot of little card games going on. Basically, hearts is what we played. We never really played for money. Occasionally for pennies, but we never really played for any money. I do know in some of the other parts of the ship, within the deckhands or within the snipes being the guys in the engineering department, the deckhands being the deck apes, there was some true gambling going on. But within our section, there really wasn't, outside of occasionally maybe a dollar's worth of pennies. That was a rare, very rare occasion. And mostly it was just playing for fun, to kill time and things like that.
What about physical activity? I mean, I know you had your job, but was there recreational?
There was no recreation. We had no room on board the ship to do anything. Well, they did have a couple dumbbells and barbells sitting there. And there were a couple guys who used to go out there and work on them. But I could never see the sense of going out there and working with stuff like that. I'm basically lazy. Plus that, my excuse was, well, what if I got it up and the ship moves? And, you know, that was an excuse. But we did have some guys who did work out in that. But that was the very limit of what we had on board ship. They were supposed to be, and they were introducing it when I got in, that you were supposed to be doing calisthenics, jumping jacks and things like that. Our ship was just too small to do stuff like that. to do it on the metal decks and everything, you don't want to say that 24 hours a day somebody was trying to sleep, but almost that's true. And okay, and now all of a sudden you're up there, you're bouncing up and down on the deck, causing all this noise. It's bad enough when they're going around chipping the paint for repainting and everything. That we occasionally did stuff when we were tied up to the pier. We'd go over, and it was the biggest joke in the world because I never understood the. You had to weigh so much, your fiber and all this sort of stuff. If you could do your job and everything, what was the big deal about worrying about that? But they were, the health nuts were starting to come in when I left. I understand it's the health nuts are still there now that okay. you gotta doing this, you know, certain weight and things like that.
These are just some things that I had wondered about. That's okay. What I was trying to say. Oh, living here in Frankfort, and they have their local river rats, kids that grew up and played in and out of the river. Did you have any water background, swimming, whatever, being there?
I had no background. Matter of fact, I never knew how to swim. I was never allowed in a pool when I was a kid. I was going to get polio, according to my mom, unless you weren't allowed in the pool. I went in the Navy not knowing how to swim. And one of the things you have to do to get out of boot camp is swim. I barely made it around the pool that I was supposed to do. They take you up on a 500-foot high tar. At least I think it was 500 foot high. It might have been 600 feet high. I don't know how high it was, but I think it was that high. You have your swim trunks on. You have on a life belt or a life jacket. You have to jump off of it into the water, and then you have to swim the length of the pool with that on, and then you got to jump in the pool without a life jacket on and swim. I could come up on my back, float on my back, and sort of pull myself around the pool. Could I swim? No, but I could get around the pool. You know, if you're out in the middle of the ocean and the ship sinks and everything, and it's 2,000 feet deep underneath you and everything. If they don't get you within the first 30 minutes or so,
you're gone,
you know. Why worry about it?
The one of the things when you were talking about the exercise thing, the size of the ship, I know nothing about.
Okay. Give me a... We were roughly, if I remember correctly, 360 feet long. It might have been a little bit longer than that, about 40 feet wide. If I remember correctly.
So compare that to something that's...
We're about a little more than a football field long, maybe from the end of a football field to the end of the football field, just talking where the touchdown area to touchdown area at the end, where that about 40 feet wide. We had one deck above the main deck, which was the O1 deck, which ran part of the ship. Then we had the bridge above that. We had two twin 5-inch guns forward, one twin 5-inch gun aft. We had one twin 3-inch gun aft on the O1 deck. In the after part of the ship, where I was berthed, we went down one deck, and there were sleeping quarters. Beneath that was the after 5-inch gun magazine and the oil tanks. As you went farther forward, the next compartment was the same way. Then you went to the engine room, boiler room, and then you were up in the mess deck area, which you had the mess deck, and underneath that was sleeping quarters. You went a little bit farther, you had the head, the restrooms, sleeping quarters underneath that, and then underneath that was the sonar shack. Underneath that was the skin of the ship where stores were, and you went forward to the front of the ship, bow of the ship. There was the chief's mess cooking area, the chief's sleeping area underneath that, and then beneath them were storage areas, and then the sonar dome. So that was.
So it wasn't a real big.
Oh, no, it wasn't big. It wasn't big at all, you know. So that's why I'm saying there really wasn't. We had, I think it was 320 officers and men on board ship. My sleeping space I slept in was 6 feet long, 2 feet wide by about 12 inches high.
So you were like sardines.
Yeah, I was like sardines. And yeah, there was a guy right next to me. I slept, my head was against his head was against my feet. There was a 2 foot space, and then there was a wall of bunks on the other side of me. I had a bulkhead in back of my head, so I was up against the bulkhead. Directly above me was 2 hydraulic lines, an air pressure line, asbestos, and a steel beam. The wall in back of me was asbestos, and the wall over on the other side. We lived in an asbestos compartment and everything, you know. We all should be dead from asbestos.
Are there very many asbestos-related claims to what you're in, or is that something?
All my my VFW magazine and stuff like that has always got big ads from lawyers about asbestos claims and everything to sue the federal government and get your fair share of money. I really think it was a bunch of bullshit. I may be wrong, because it was all sealed and everything. What's going to happen? It's unless you go and cut it and stir it up. Okay, just like the deck was asbestos. You know, it was asbestos tiles. Everything was made out of asbestos in those days. It wasn't fibers. It was solid material put together. And, you know, so anyway. Interesting about the lawyers and the asbestos claims and that.
And let's see, the other thing I guess I would ask you is about the post health care, the situation that's going on with veterans. And
my health care in the Navy. Let's talk about that first.
Okay, yeah.
Health care in the Navy and everything. Polio. What was it? The Salk vaccination came out. I don't know. You took it in a sugar cube. Well, I remember I did that right before I went in the Navy. You took 3 of them, and I took 2 of them. I didn't get the third one. They were spread out. You took one. There was, I think it was a month, and then there was maybe a 3-month, and you took another one. So I got in the Navy, and they found out, no, I hadn't done that. I told them. So in boot camp, I take the first one. I take the second one. Don't get the third one before I'm out of boot camp. So I go to radar school, and I'm in radar school for a while. Oh, you only have your 3 things. So I took my first one, I took my second one, and I was going for radar school. So when I was on board ship, they finally got all 3 of them in me along the way. So I hit that. The naval on board ship, we had a first class hospital corpsman, and we had a seaman in the Navy who was striking to be a corpsman and everything. They provided basic health service. Basically, they had hanging on their door 2 big containers. One was salt tablets, and one was aspirins. Take one or the other and come back and see it at 8 o'clock in the morning. I found the salt tablets, and I don't understand why the government is banning salt tablets, but salt tablets really cured a whole bunch of things that were wrong, because what I figured out was you were just getting dehydrated. And you needed the water and the salt. You drank water and salt, and boy, my headache was gone, and I'm feeling better and everything. So that was it. And then they would do the sick call. They could treat basics, cold and stuff like that. Our 4-ship squadron that we were in, I was in Des Div 192, Destroyer Division 192, which was part of Destroyer Squadron 19, which was a total of 8 ships. Within the 8 ships, they did have 1 dock. And he would ride around and everything. Never had called to deal with him and everything, but he was there in case something went wrong. There was also, I'm going to get off on my hobby horse again, there was also a chaplain that rode on the 8 ships. He occasionally came on board our ship. I don't know what he was doing in the Navy, but he was not there to serve and take care of his fellow man. All he did was hang around with the officers. I never saw him once go around to counsel, work with enlisted men, many who had some serious problems, marital problems, and other problems. And I never saw that, quote, support done. I understand the military does it now. I don't know. But it definitely wasn't back in those days. Okay. I went to the dentist one time with a bad tooth. They took care of the tooth with no problem. I never really had any real medical stuff within the Navy and everything. I do know a couple guys who did go in and got stuff. I never heard them really complain about it and everything. Now you mentioned VA. The 10 years or so ago, they sent me a form to fill out for VA and everything. I filled it out and sent it in. They ask you health questions. They ask you about awards you got in the service and so forth and so on. They ask questions about your marital status. They ask questions about your financial status and everything. And I got it back, and I was in class. Let's just say I was in class 8 is what they put me in. And they said, we're sorry, but we are only funded to treat class 1 and 2.
Okay.
So I wasn't. I've never used the thing. My VA benefits have been a laugh. When we went and bought our house, I went to use my VA benefit, and I was better off going with a conventional loan than using my VA loan. The VA loan was going to cost me more. GI Bill, paying to go to school and everything, that was not in effect when I went through college and that. When it was passed, and I said, oh, gee, this is neat. I wanted to go up to K-State and take some computer courses. And they came back to me and said, no, you can't do that. You can only, if you want to go for a doctorate, we'll your VA will kick in. But since you already got a bachelor's and a master's, your thing is no good. And then the other thing I was going to do was I was going to get me a pilot license, because we had an airplane for a while. I flew it. I never got a license. I was, you know, just never. Well, they would only pay for if you already had your pilot's license and was going for a commercial license. So I never got.
So you haven't really gotten.
I never got anything out of the
benefits.
Out of the quote the benefits that I was supposed to gotten out of the benefits, but it's the way the game runs. Things break and everything. So that's what happened. I didn't get any benefits.
And you've kind of fell between in the cracks.
Though. Right. Well, since you said that, we're going to talk about one other thing that ain't part of this. I was born in 1940. Your husband was born in 1940, right?
Right.
He and I, we have no identification.
That's true.
When you look at what they talk about the cohorts, they talk about the Depression kids, they talk about another group, and then they jump to the, what do they call them, the post-war babies, or what?
Baby boomers.
The baby boomer. And they, wait, us guys that were born between 1940 and 1945, we're an unidentified cohort. I brought that up in a class I was taking at Ohio State umpteen years ago. And I said, you know, you go boom, 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 boom. You skip over us. Well, he said, well, I never thought about that. And then they just went on. We were a non-entity out there. The 1940 and 1945... it's not a Generation X, they're not a Generation Y, they're not the Depression kids, they're not the baby boomers.
I'll have to bring that to his attention.
Well, mention to it. I mean, and watch, anytime they talk about cohorts, that little narrow group there, they talk about the greatest generation. Maybe that's what I am, the greatest generation, because I was born during that period, you know. Maybe that's what I'm supposed to say, but it's okay. Back to the Navy. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I would, anybody I've told to go in, I do have, like I said, I have some problems with the modern Navy. But then again, I'm an old fogey, and most probably the kids today, it's part of their culture, and they would slide right into that way of doing things now, which I would have extreme difficulty sliding into. And my wife, who is, I figure, fairly liberal, always trusted me and things like that. It said she isn't too sure how she would feel if I was in the Navy and everything. Not because she didn't think I would be doing anything. It's just that being within the proximity of members of the opposite sex, close proximity, no way to get away from. Now, what I'm trying to say is you're being put in a situation that almost, it's like being in a college dorm that's co-ed.
You're asking for trouble.
You're asking for it because the opportunities are all there, and both sides, both male and female, there are some who are promiscuous, or whatever you want to say, that are always looking to score and things like that. And I worked with some women. I worked with some men that were like that, and it just, okay. We got off on another subject and everything.
Let's see. Any awards or medals, that type thing?
For some reason, I did come out with a good conduct medal, although I had one of my officers tell me one day he'd like to take me out back out on the O-1 deck and beat the hell out of me. And as I've said, I most probably deserved that comment that day. Many, many other days, most probably, too. I got a Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal, which I said for just being on board the ship operating in the foremost of straits. I got the Berlin Wall Medal, which was the Occupation Medal. I was supposed to have been in the Navy for 3 years. I went in at 17, almost getting ready to turn 18. I was supposed to get out on my 21st birthday. The Berlin Wall came along as involuntarily extended for 6 months. Because of the involuntary extension, I wound up getting a Navy Occupation Medal coming in. And I got the National Defense Medal, which is also was given to anybody that was in the services between such and such a date and such and such a date. If I would hit, I got on the Navy on December 17th, I think it was, something like that. And if I'd been in the Navy on December the 21st, I would have got a Vietnam medal because the Vietnam thing started about 4 days after I got out. And anybody that was in the Navy at that time got that for being. I was off the Vietnam coast and everything. And I asked about that because we were in 71, so it's December of 71 is I think when it kicks in. We were off the Vietnam coast early in 71 when things are starting to kick up and everything. And the carrier we were with, I don't think flew any real missions ashore, but they were putting aircraft up and everything.
So did you have any thoughts of re-upping or when Vietnam heated up or anything?
I had thought about I was ready to go to college. I had reached that much maturity to go to college. When I got home, I didn't do anything for about the first 6 months, maybe a little bit longer, maybe a year. I was going to go down and join the Navy Reserves. And at which point, I did a very dumb thing. The Vietnam War, of course, had started to kick in. Draftees were going there and everything. And I walked down into the Navy Reserve and said, I'd sort of like to sign up for the Navy Reserve. And the guy said, oh, here's another one of those draft dodgers coming in. And since you're a lady, I won't use the language, I said to him. I just got out of the Navy for 3.5 years. I said I was going to come down and join the Reserve. Oh, that's different. And I told him a couple other things and walked out. And I shouldn't have done that. I should have gone through, seen about signing up and everything. Because I have a friend who did that. And he went to 2 weeks a year, just like the Guard, went off and everything. That retired out of the Reserves as a chief and is drawing a nice little retirement for that. And because I was young, dumb, stupid, whatever you want to do, and hot-headed, I shot myself in the foot.
He just said the wrong words to you that day.
He said the wrong words to me on the wrong day. And normally I would have blown stuff like that off. It wouldn't have done anything. But I don't know what got to me that day. And a couple times there afterwards, I started to go down. I did. Then I was going to join the National Guard when I came to Frankfurt. That would have been 65. And I was having stomach problems at the time. Long story, they were treating me for, ulcers and stuff like that, and colitis and all those sort of things. I don't know if you ever knew Dr. Card here in town. He later, when Dr. Card became my doctor and everything, anyway, he said to me, he says, you ain't got that. What do you do in your morning when you get sick and everything? I said, well, I have a bowl of cereal every morning. He says, quit having your bowl of cereal in the milk and let's see what happens. And I came back and said, it's okay now, but I have it later in the day. And he says, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I sort of drink coffee or some Mountain Dew. He says, well, let's quit doing that to see what happens. And I was a new person. But anyway, when I wanted to, I was going to join the car. First off, the ulcer kicked me out. That immediately did it. And then when I went back and said, oh, that's gone, what they find out I had is lactose intolerant. And if I had been in the guard, it would have been so noted. But because I wasn't in the guard, I didn't meet their physical to get in. So once again, there's luck to the draws along the way. Sometimes you're in the right place, sometimes you're in the wrong place.
Just for the record, and before we end, tell me again the ship that you were on and everything, so for the record here.
I was on the USS Dennis J. Buckley, DDR 808. It was a destroyer built in 1945 at Bath Ironwork up in Maine. It was converted into a radar picket ship. It was a gearing class destroyer. It was armed with three twin 5-inch guns, 2 forward, 1 aft, and it had a twin 3-inch gun on the rear. And that I was a radarman. We had when I came on board, we had a SG-6 surface search radar, SPS-6 air search radar, and SPS-8A height-finding radar. When I left, we had an SPS-6. We had SPS-10 surface search, SPS-37 air search, and had the SPS 8A height finder radar still on board. We were operated out of Long Beach. We were part of, as I said, Destroyer Squadron 19, Destroyer Division 192. The ships in the division were Cal, Pritchett, Cushing, which were Fletcher class ships, and then the Dennis J. Buckley, which was a gearing class ship. The gearings and the Fletchers, just for your information, were the same ship, basically, same power plant, same everything, except the gearing was a little bit longer, a foot wider, and instead of having 5 single-inch guns, it had 3 twin-inch guns.
Okay.
It was an upgrade of the Fletcher, but it was the same hull and everything. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your interview.
Okay.
And we'll be getting back with you.
Okay.
How's that?